MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and welcome to a new edition of Spy Talk. Jeff Stein is off today, and Karen Greenberg will be joining us later when we will be joined by a former FBI agent, Mike German. But we're going to start off with a very special guest, Congresswoman Mary Gay Scanlon, who, as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, had a steely and highly illuminating exchange last week with Attorney General Pam Bondi over a question with enormous civil liberties implications. Has the Justice Department compiled a secret list of domestic terror groups as directed by a memo signed by President Trump last fall? And if so, who's on it and why? Let's listen to some of that.
Can we assume that you or persons under your direction at the Department of Justice have prepared that list of groups or entities who are designated as domestic terrorist organizations? And I just remind you, that's a yes or no question.
Well, I'm not going to answer it yes or no, but what I will say is I know Antifa is part of that. I will talk to you about
that.
An Antifa member was arrested in Minneapolis federal court for cyber stalking. Did you have a question and don't want an answer?
The answer is yes or no.
I'm DeLong, the gentlelady from Pennsylvania. Gentlelady, can proceed.
Okay. So, will you commit to providing this committee with any list of organizations that you have recommended be designated as domestic terrorist organizations?
We will comply with the law in all matters.
Okay, we are now joined by Congresswoman Mary Gay Scanlon, a Democrat representing the 5th Congressional District in Pennsylvania, encompassing mostly Delaware County suburbs west of Philadelphia. Congresswoman, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thank you for having me on.
So I have to say, congressional hearings these days rarely produce little new information. Instead, they've largely become an opportunity for members to post snappy, clickbait-worthy videos about their political foes on the other side of the aisles. But your questioning of Attorney General Bondi last week, you actually focused public attention on something that I think has gotten far too little coverage in the media, and that is something called NSPM-7, signed by President Trump last October. Tell us what this memo is and how you got onto this in the first place.
Sure. So I'm so pleased that that is what happened, because as you said, congressional hearings have become much less about actually getting information, particularly from this administration, than it is about people trying to get sound bites. And we certainly knew that was what AG Bondi was aiming for when she came in, based on her prior appearances before Congress. But you're exactly right. What we were trying to do was bring attention to this NSPM-7, this sweeping directive from the White House to really blur the lines between protected First Amendment speech and what this administration is calling domestic terrorism. Now, there is no crime of domestic terrorism in our country, and that is largely because it is so difficult to insulate protected speech. But generally, there must be actions of a criminal nature in order to constitute terrorism. And this memo from the president directing basically a whole of government approach to go after what it has generally characterized as leftist organizations, whether using the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the IRS, basically bringing a whole of government approach to crack down on left-leaning organizations. And when this memo came out in October, it really sent shockwaves through some of the areas most impacted, when people could notice it in amidst all the other chaos that's going on. But our concern was that it really did cross a line and really does seem to have the administration set up to have an enemies list of folks to go after based on ideologies, speech, et cetera. And we did want to bring that to the attention of the American people in general.
And some of the language in there, which you quoted from in your questioning, in which the president talks about common recurrent motivations and indicia uniting this pattern of violence and terroristic activities. Common threads animating this violent conduct include anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, support for the overthrow of the U.S. government, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and hostility towards those who hold traditional American views on family, religion, and morality.
It was kind of a hit list of things that this administration and Project 2025, quite frankly, have been trying to attack. And it was partnered with the administration's earlier pronouncements with respect to Antifa, which by all accounts is not actually an organization, but has been the left-wing whipping post for this administration. And it came out, all this came out in the wake of the murder of Charlie Kirk. And this NSPM 7 memo focused just on assaults, the attempted assassinations of the president, and assaults on right-wing figures, and completely ignored what had happened with respect to the Pennsylvania governor, the legislators in Minnesota. So just this warping of what is actually happening with respect to violence connected to political extremism. At the same time that this thing was coming out, they took down research on the Department of Justice website that made clear that for decades, the greatest domestic terrorism threat for Americans has come from right-wing extremism, even as we have this administration saying, oh, no, it's all left-wing, and then putting together tools that would allow the government to, as they put it, dismantle organizations in which anyone is participating and might have these beliefs, regardless of whether they act on it. So it really is an authoritarian government style imposition on Americans' right to speak their minds, to believe what they want to believe, in the name of trying to brand it as domestic terrorism.
And you made a couple of important points on this, that there's no mention of any right-wing violence in this memo or terrorism, no mention of the Proud Boys, no mention of January 6th at all, even though the memo calls for prosecution of groups according to the U.S. Code definition of terrorism, which includes attempts to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. That sounds like a definition of January 6th itself.
Right.
But you focused in particular on the idea of this secret list.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell us why that was so important to you, that there is an actual list of groups that are being targeted by the Justice Department, but we have no idea who they are.
Well, that came from a couple of places. First of all, the NSPM 7 issued by the president specifically directed Pam Bondi as attorney general to compile such a list and provide it to the president and Stephen Miller, his right-hand wingman, whatever he is. So that was a directive. It was a concrete action that was supposed to be undertaken. And in response to that, Attorney General Bondi had put out her own memo on December 4th of 2025, which in some ways was more sweeping with respect to what kind of groups she wanted to target, and directed that this list was to be prepared by January 3rd of 2026 and then updated every 30 days thereafter. So knowing that we had a, shall we say, recalcitrant witness coming in, but she was under direct orders from the president to do something, and she'd committed to doing it by a date which had already passed and even should have updated it once already. It felt like there were some very concrete things we could focus on. And in addition to that was this kind of growing buzz that we're hearing from around the country, particularly with respect to ICE and Customs and Border Patrol enforcement activities, that they are taking photographs of people. They are saying to individuals, you're now on our terrorist database, that people who are observing these immigration enforcement actions are finding themselves followed to their homes. So clearly someone is keeping data on someone. And we thought this was a way to get it. And we did get sort of an admission by omission in which she said, well, Antifa's part of it. So, you know, kind of a backhanded admission. If I had,
we kind of know it was going to be Antifa because the president had already signed executive orders on Antifa just a couple of weeks earlier than this presidential memo.
Well, the other piece of it is if we'd gotten any kind of actual answers to questions, I wanted to dig into exactly what you mentioned there. Okay, if it's, you know, people who want to overthrow the government, impede law enforcement, et cetera, are the Proud Boys or the leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers on that list, because some of them were actually convicted and not pardoned. Their sentences were commuted, but so they are actually legally should be on that list. And if they're not on that list, why not? And then my constituents, the folks who are going to Indivisible, No Kings rallies, et cetera, would like to know if they're on the list.
So what can you do about this? You're in the minority. I mean, are there other members, are there any Republicans who are as concerned about, you know, this kind of activity, which traditionally they have been authoritarian steps by the federal government to snoop on American citizens? I mean, has there been any follow-up, or is there any attempt but you and others to press this issue, to force at least public disclosure of what apparently Pam Bondi has already done, which is compile this list?
Right. Well, the other thing we tried to do was draw the contrast, because there actually is a law about designating foreign terrorist organizations, and that law requires publication in the Federal Register of who they are, and it has a process for people to or for those organizations to appeal their inclusion in case there's a mistake. So we wanted to raise the fact that since this is a made-up process, there is no way for Americans to get off this government list. And that is the kind of thing that we think will be actually compelling to some of our Republican colleagues who've been so reluctant to allow the government to invade people's privacy and to compile enemies lists. And certainly with this administration's track record, you're only a friend as long as you are useful. And almost everyone ends up on an enemies list at some point. So I think they should be concerned. You know, clearly the most support that we'll get this will probably be from more libertarian members such as Thomas Massie, et cetera. But
well, have you gotten any word that Massie or others might back you on forcing disclosure of this list?
We're continuing to press it. We just had the hearing last week, and then Congress promptly adjourned. Mr. Massie was still fending off AG Bondi's attacks on the Epstein files at the time, but we are reaching out. We are following up. You know, as part of the hearing process, you have a number of days in which to submit additional questions. So we are submitting the questions that we would have asked if the AG had been in any position to answer questions as opposed to hurling insults. So,
she doesn't seem inclined to want to answer questions, but are there particular questions you have at this point? And are there any further steps you can take while you're still in the minority?
Well, in the minority, obviously, it's difficult. We will be trying to build a bipartisan coalition about this. And, you know, there
to
are
to force disclosure. Is that your first priority here?
I think forcing disclosure, who's on the list, what is the list, who's maintaining it. We've also asked questions about how was the list compiled, because, you know, the big concern is that you've now blurred or crossed lines to protected First Amendment speech. So, you know, what kind of criteria did people use to compile this list? We're seeing related concerns in a couple areas. Again, impacting some of my constituents, we know that DHS is using this administrative warrant process to get the social media companies to unmask the identities of people who are being critical of DHS and ICE. And it's a process that, again, puts the burden on the American who's exercising their free speech rights in order to try to quash a subpoena that they may or may not get notice of before they're actually unmasked. And it's an onerous process. So we're going to be pushing on that issue as well. And then we've got the FISA reauthorization coming up. And that has historically been an issue where we get bipartisan interest in should this statute be amended or altered to require warrants? So they're all kind of...
And where are you on that one?
I've been on the side of, if you're going to sweep up Americans' data, you should have a warrant. That's okay. What the Constitution requires. And
how does it look right now? I think it only passed by like one vote, 702 reauthorization last time around.
I suspect that we'll end up with the judiciary folks fighting the national security folks again. But everybody's attention has been elsewhere on big bad bills and Epstein files and everything else. Right. So I think that's just starting to come into focus. But I think it'll be a battle again and one where you start having these kind of strange alliances, AOC and Jim Jordan on one side and some other folks on the other side.
Yeah. So last question for you. A lot of people have compared this memo, the Trump memo, to the Red Scare after World War I, when a young justice bureaucrat named J. Edgar Hoover began compiling lists of radical aliens who could be rounded up and deported. And then, of course, there was the second Red Scare in the 1950s with Joseph McCarthy and blacklists. Do you see parallels to those dark eras? Are we in the midst of a Trump ginned up Antifa scare?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do think there are parallels, although I find this one more disturbing because the president's memo explicitly invokes a whole of government approach to pursuing folks who have these so-called ideologies. And we're already seeing some action of it, whether it's DHS folks following protesters home and saying, we know where you live. Or in Minnesota, when I was out there for a hearing in January, there was reporting about a small business owner who'd offered support to protesters. And the next day, they had treasury authorities in their business office, wanting to look at the books. So we are seeing an administration that is only too willing to use prosecution, government action, and just intimidation in order to silence dissent.
So you, just to be clear, you think this is worse or more concerning than the McCarthy era and the anti-communist Red Scares of the 50s?
I think in some ways, because the people who hold all the levers of power right now are pursuing that. I mean, McCarthy ginned up a lot of public sentiment and public pressure and pressured businesses, et cetera, but was less successful in actually wielding all the power of government.
Well, that is a very concerning observation, I have to say. But look, I really appreciate you taking the time. We, of course, are really interested in this issue, and I hope we can stay in touch. And if you get any answers or can take any further steps, please let us know.
Well, answers, any data you uncover, whistleblowers, we're happy to talk to folks.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
And now we are joined by Mike German, veteran, former FBI counterterrorism agent, former fellow at the Brennan Center for Liberty and National Security Policy, and former policy counsel for national security at the ACLU. Mike, welcome back to Spy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I had mentioned when we booked you, we were really struck by Congresswoman Scanlon's questioning of AG Bondi last week about the secret terror list that was apparently she was authorized to create by something called NSPM 7, a memo, not an executive order, but a memo from the president about investigating and listing, identifying domestic terrorism groups. I got to say, I don't know about you, but when I actually read the text, there's some pretty chilling passages. Give us your take on NSPM 7 and what it means.
Largely, I think it's saying the quiet part out loud, which is part of what the Trump administration brought, both the first Trump administration and this Trump administration, in reviving language that was all too prevalent in the past, from the first Red Scare during and after World War I to the second Red Scare, that there was this tendency to view any leftist protest or advocacy as a threat to the nation, as a national.
Can I just break in for one moment on your reference to the Red Scare of after World War I? Which, of course, is how J. Edgar Hoover got his start at the Justice Department, identifying radicals for deportation from the United States. And he made up master lists of thousands of people.
Exactly. The index lists.
Yeah.
So named because he was an old had been trained as a librarian. And used index cards to identify troublesome individuals. And that list took several different iterations throughout the tenure, the multi-decade tenure of J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. So this creating enemies lists is something that's been part of our national security strategy for 100 years or more.
And yet when you say saying the quiet part out loud, which I think is such a good overview of what's going on with Trump 1.0 and now, do you really think that, I mean, that would be a secret list if there were one now, right? Would be the idea. And as you say, in the past, these lists have been secret, but they've known about the list, but not necessarily who's on them. Do you expect that at some point this would become the quiet part out loud, or that this is a secret list is important to whatever would follow from having such a list?
I don't think that who is on the list is nearly important as the chilling effect of creating such a list, particularly using the guilt by association methodology that, you know, again, was used during the Red Scares and through COINTELPRO, you know, identifying and frankly, the resurrection of this radicalization problem that the government adopted after 9/11. You know, this idea that the people who are doing harm aren't the problem. It's the people who are spreading ideas we don't like that are the problem. So,
and would you include, are you talking about material support statutes? Are you talking about the idea of material support and how broadly it can be applied and was applied after 9/11?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. And you know, those statutes were created to move the locus of the investigation away from the people who are actually doing harm, away from the people who are making bombs, who are planting bombs, who are committing assassinations, and move it to people who are engaged in political organizing. And you know, we've had conspiracy laws on the books for a long time, and in fact, it was fascinating to me over the past 10 or 15 years when the conversation moved from international terrorism to domestic terrorism. There was this idea that material support statutes didn't apply to domestic terrorism.
Right, and they couldn't pass an act. Right.
Right, and had never been true. And,
right.
And they were just rarely used. And people would say, well, how come they're so rarely used in domestic terrorism? And I would explain, because we have conspiracy statutes. You know, to the extent that there is somebody who is assisting in a criminal act, they can be charged under conspiracy, which had been on the books for decades. So the judges understood them, the prosecutors understood them, juries understood them. You bring up a new material support statute, and it's a little more complicated and a little harder to understand. And prosecutors know that there isn't a lengthy body of casework that they can rely on in making their prosecutive decisions. So they would rely on conspiracy statutes instead. But now, because we're trying to create this chilling effect, I think you'll see more cases that could have been charged as conspiracies now being charged as material support.
But Mike, the distinction between domestic terrorist list and a foreign terrorist list is that the foreign terrorist list is public. So if you're giving money to an organization that's supporting an identified foreign terrorist organization, you're on notice that you're doing something illegal. But if we have a secret list of domestic terrorism, how can you be charged with material support for an organization that has not been identified publicly as a terrorist organization? How are you supposed to know that the money, the group you're giving money to, is on this secret list? Because it's a secret list.
So I challenge somewhat the idea of a public list versus a secret list. You know, you go try to find all the entities that are on that list, and it's very difficult in the first place.
But foreign terrorist organizations are designated by the State Department, right?
Through a completely opaque methodology that doesn't give them a proper means to challenge that designation. Yes, but if you are very sophisticated and have good lawyers who know how to search those lists, you can try to apply for a license to assist them in a defense against some charge or to try to get them off the list. But you're right. The difference is 2339, section 2339A versus section 2339B, which is the foreign terrorist organization list. 2339A, which is what applies to domestic terrorism, links to a domestic terrorist act. So there are 52 federal crimes of terrorism that are included under the terrorism chapter of the criminal code. Again, you know, this was part of this false narrative that there were no domestic terrorism statutes. There are dozens of them.
Statutes that could be used to target domestic terrorism
that are called federal crimes of terrorism.
Okay.
There is an entire chapter of the U.S. Criminal Code titled terrorism.
Right.
And then it lists all the federal crimes of terrorism. So,
but why were they so hepped on having a federal domestic terrorism act then? Wasn't the reason so they could have a list that was what they called an official list? I mean, isn't that part of what it was?
Absolutely. To make it easier to do what Trump's doing now.
Right.
That this idea, this concept of radicalization, which through empirical studies has been disproven and discredited. The theory is that people adopt radical ideas, then they engage in radical political activities, then they become a terrorist. So if only you move up the chain, you can stop them by focusing on the people spreading radical ideas. Again, this is something that animated the Lusk Committee in New York City in the 19-teens, the Overman Committee in Congress, this idea that it's not the people doing bad acts, it's the people spreading dangerous ideas that we need to suppress, which of course goes against the whole notion of the First Amendment.
Yeah. On that point, I referred earlier to some chilling passages in that memo. As you point out, there is statutes, of course, for terrorism, terrorist crimes. But what this memo does is vastly expand how the federal government is going to look at that. And I'm just reading a couple of passages from this memo signed by the president back in October. There are common recurrent motivations and indicia using this pattern of violent and terroristic activities under the umbrella of self-described anti-fascism. These movements portray foundational American principles, for example, support for law enforcement and border control, as fascist to justify and encourage acts of violent revolution. Common threads animating this violent conduct include anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, support for the overthrow of the U.S. government, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and hostility towards those who hold traditional American values on family, religion, and morality. That seems like awfully loose language through which a lot of conduct, which we traditionally view as First Amendment protected, can be fit in and used to prosecute.
Absolutely. And that is entirely the point, that it's directed at those groups that advocate in favor of those ideas or could be accused of doing so, so that they are chilled from engaging in the type of political activities and protests that they would normally engage in, right? That the whole point of it is to suppress political opposition. And, but, you know, I don't think the FBI or the Justice Department needed much of a push to do that, right? You might remember after 9/11 on the domestic terrorism front, the FBI publicly declared eco-terrorism the number one domestic threat. There wasn't a single homicide identifiable and related to environmental activism, and yet the FBI was putting its domestic terrorism resources into chasing animal rights activists and environmentalists, and have been doing that for 25 years. Just the other day, there was this round of FBI agent visits to activists who were part of Extinction Rebellion, I think it's called. So, and in 2010, the department, based on a ACLU Freedom of Information Act expose of Joint Terrorism Task Force investigations targeting leftist groups, PETA, Greenpeace, the Thomas Merton Center for Peace and Justice, the Inspector General report, which didn't come out until 2010, literally 6 years after the events, found that the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force had indeed investigated these groups without proper predication. At the time, under the 2002 FBI guidelines, the FBI just needed an allegation to open what was called a preliminary investigation. And they opened these investigations based on allegations the agents were making against these centers and kept them open for long periods of time. So, you know, this tendency of the FBI to target leftist groups much more aggressively, leftist protest and advocacy groups much more aggressively than they investigate white supremacist violence has been prevalent throughout the history of the FBI.
And on that note, I should point out that there's in this memo in which it identifies all the actions of Antifa and other leftist groups and political plots against conservatives, including the president himself, of course, there's no mention of right-wing violence, terrorism, extremism, no mention of January 6th at all. And the part of the federal code that this memo directs the FBI to prosecute under after they've identified these groups is the definition in the code. It includes attempts to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Well, what was January 6th other than that? And there's not a single mention of it as an example of terrorism.
Or even a recognition that at least one of the attempted assassinations of President Trump involved somebody whose viewpoint fit more in the anti-Semitic right wing than you would characterize him as an anti-capitalist or any of the other.
And there doesn't seem to be a fear that used this way as a weapon against political opponents and enemies would reverberate back on them once there was somebody else, some other government in power. Is that? Or is it just that, do you think it's that they're just not worried about it, or do they think that this kind of reign is going to go on, you know, indefinitely?
I think they have a better understanding of how the Department of Justice and the FBI are so inherently predisposed to not view right-wing extremism that way. I mean, that was what was fascinating to me in the post 9/11 counterterrorism world, where you had this viewpoint that allowed them, and the change in the FBI's authorities that allowed them to target people two or three times removed from the person who committed a terrorist act. But they wouldn't do that in cases involving right-wing violence, where they would almost immediately after an example of it would come out and say, this was a lone wolf. You know, that we don't see any further problem. And in fact, they don't even bother to count the bodies, right? They don't have an accurate count of the number of people white supremacists kill every year. They don't collect that information. And there was a bill passed in Congress in 2020, the National Defense Authorization Act, that required them to file reports annually that provided that kind of accounting. And they admitted openly, we don't collect data on domestic terrorism attacks. What? That's your
well
primary.
Now they do, but the kind the only the domestic terrorism count
right and again I think this is less about identifying instances of domestic terrorism than about chilling, you know, it. So you're a group that believes in any one of these, you know, open borders or some idea, it, you know, anti-capitalism, whatever, one of the list of ideas that are listed as dangerous in the memorandum, and you want to fund groups that go out and do protests. And 99% of the groups that go out and do protests do that in a peaceful way and engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And now all of a sudden, if one person throws a brick at a police officer, oh, wait a minute. You know, is that now going to make the government come down on me as a funding organization for groups whose protests I think are valuable to, you know, increasing our democratic participation? You know, that's what it's intended to do.
Good question. We got to take a quick break now. And when we come back, we have some questions about the current state of the FBI under Kash Patel and upcoming 702 reauthorization, which is going to be a major civil liberties issue coming up. And we are back with Mike German. I believe, Karen, you had some questions.
So I think we sort of addressed this a little before, but you know, given how the FBI reacted after 9/11 to be able to broaden and in fact weaken categories and specifics about who and what they were going after and for what reasons, I'm wondering if you get the sense that there's any kind of pushback in the FBI about the kinds of policies that are now being either unleashed or suggested that may be unleashed going forward? Is there, or is this something where we, in order to fix it, we'd need to have a complete rethinking of how the FBI is structured and how it operates?
That's a great question. I'm sure that there are still lots of good people in the FBI who are doing their best to resist this kind of these changes to the FBI. But I think people don't realize how much the Department of Justice and the FBI being an element of the Department of Justice were politicized after 9/11. You know, people talk about what the Trump administration has done, which is egregious. But the Bush administration, you might remember, did an ideological purge of U.S. attorneys and, you know, built. And, you know, I was part of that. You know, if you don't like what we're doing, here's your options. Leave or get kicked out. And so.
But,
you know,
but
there
Mike,
was,
there's a big difference between firing U.S. attorneys who are presidential appointees for a reason. They're supposed to follow the president's policy guidance, right? And as you know, what made the firing of the U.S. attorneys scandalous, I'm not quite sure it was a scandal, but it was scandalous, was the idea that in particular cases, there were cases that of voter fraud that the White House wanted them to pursue and didn't feel that the fired U.S. attorneys were doing that. That's bad, but it's nothing like firing assistant U.S. attorneys, ranking FBI special agents, ranking FBI executives, because they don't pledge a loyalty to the president of the United States. And in fact, ordering those who aren't getting fired from bringing particular cases against the president's political enemies identified by the president. That's a huge leap from where we were in the days after 9/11 under the Bush administration.
So I would suggest you read Carol Leonig's Injustice.
I have read.
We had her on the podcast.
Yeah, we've had her on the right. podcast. We've discussed it.
Which discusses how much the FBI was resistant to conducting January 6 investigations, and particularly making this leap that they make in the memorandum that, oh, it's the people who are spreading the ideas, the people who are conceiving the tactics that are the trouble, not just the people who are doing harm, right? It's the opposite. And yet what you saw was FBI strongly resisting that. And in fact, the Justice Department, right? That it's, you know, I don't think there's enough recognition of how far these institutions had moved, which goes to Karen's question. Is it retrievable at this point, right? I mean, if the Democrats' dreams come true and they're able to win the midterms and take control of Congress and somehow blunt the further destruction of our democracy through the Trump administration, and we elect a Democratic president 3 years from now, is anybody going to trust the FBI and what their agents say in a courtroom? Is anyone going to trust prosecutions are done based on facts and not fear or favor of some political retribution for those acts? I think we're in a very dangerous place. And I think we have to start conceiving of a national security and law enforcement establishment that doesn't involve these institutions. You know, the FBI had a long history of abuse under J. Edgar Hoover, had a relatively short period of reform, which wasn't perfect, right? There were investigations of leftist groups like the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador that lasted way too long and targeted them for their political advocacy rather than any actual connection to violent activities. But, you know, the rapidity at which the FBI snapped back to that J. Edgar Hoover methodology, again, bringing up this same language of radicalization, even though it had been discredited over 30 years after that theory justified putting Martin Luther King on the index lists as a dangerous person. So, you know, I think we have to come with a recognition that these institutions are severely damaged, and at this point maybe past the point of whether trying to retain them is useful. And this was a debate, you guys remember, you were part of it right after 9/11 when we were talking about tearing apart the FBI and creating new institutions. Of course, what they did
five in the United States
kept the FBI and created an even worse monstrosity, the Department of Homeland Security.
Right. Karen, 702, It's all yours. Tell us what it is and what's your question for Mike.
Well, I want to, so 702.
Tell us what 702 is.
Oh my God. I'll let Mike describe it in his, but anyway, 702 was basically the, what I call compromise legislation for the, for FISA that basically said, yes, we can surveil people who are said to be in touch with foreign terrorists. And if Americans get swept up in the incidental thing, well, we're going to store it, you know, in a place where you have to ask for that information if you want it. And it was a way to say, we're not being as abusive as we were with this warrantless massive program. On the other hand, it is, you do not need a warrant to query the information. And as part of that information, queries have been made into Americans and people who are not covered under FISA, right? Is that, was that an accurate?
Sure. Sort of, and so, you know, just to place it in time, it's basically what was the warrantless wiretapping program under President Bush, ultimately Congress legalized under.
Right. Trying to looking like it had some restraints upon it and right. Establishing some of the procedures, right. At all, right? Except that now the procedures are, instead of getting a so-called, you know, right to investigate, you, it's for a group rather than, sort of category rather than for an individual, which sort of, you know, right? So right. That sort of takes away the sort of kind of authorization we would have liked to see, the kind of curtailment we would have liked to see. So it's up for reauthorization again. And again, of course, I think the warrant issue will come up that was not approved last time. How do you see what's about to happen? That's my first question. And then my second question is, in your recent article or the last article you did for the Brennan Center, you talk about what powers state and local have. Right. And I'm just curious, because I really don't think I've seen this written about or talked about elsewhere. Do state and local, as you see it, authorities have the kind of power to block this kind of surveillance, to interfere with this kind of surveillance, to challenge this kind of surveillance? And I was just curious your thoughts on that. So both things.
So, you know, I retired from direct advocacy, so I'm not directly involved in any of these conversations. But my understanding is, you know, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has been abused throughout history. They created a secret court to monitor the government's use of national security warrants and foreign intelligence collection. But that secret, what happens in secret often degenerates. That's well known. And it often had. And the guidelines that they tried to put around this warrantless wiretapping program for 702 were routinely abused, but there was a process so those abuses would be discovered and new guidelines would be set. But it was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, regular FISA, that was used to for, that the FBI used to investigate Carter Page, who then was a Trump. So Trump became very anti-FISA, and a lot of the MAGA world became very anti-FISA. So there's an opportunity if Trump maintains his skepticism of whether FISA can be used without engaging in some kind of abuse, that it would be retired at this point.
Let's remember that Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, was a consistent opponent of 702 and the failure. To
Right. A lot of the people in the establishment now were following Trump's lead.
But would you both agree, Karen and Mike, that it is a critical tool in identifying foreign terrorist plots? Do you agree, Mike?
I don't think there's any public evidence suggesting that's true.
But there are a lot of public statements about it. You have oh my God. There's so many national security officials, leaders, et cetera, who have said without 702, they literally have said without 702.
Both parties, Democrat and Republican.
Well, I would say they said the same thing about Section 215.
Yes,
until
they did.
That was retired.
Right.
And it turned out when information was made public through Edward Snowden, not through any watchdogs, oversight committees, that in fact it wasn't very useful. And that's kind of the point, is if I take all internet traffic that goes overseas and put it into one basket, of course, that basket becomes useful because I don't have to do an individual wiretap. But that doesn't mean that that's an appropriate way to do it. Then it would be, why stop at the border? You know, it would be useful if they were, you know, able to kick down every door that they wanted to. Would they ever
let me just push down here to just further your point in another way. More doesn't mean more focused, more specific, more, you know, intelligent about who's doing what. It's like rounding people up in the war on terror and detaining them and not really having information on them, like we did at Guantanamo, and then trying to figure out who they were, what they were, what's going on. I mean, as I understand law enforcement, they're supposed to follow evidence and follow leads, not just because it's lawful, but because it's the best way to figure out who's responsible, who's guilty, and, you know, who's a threat.
So the argument against the warrants, at least in the days when I was covering this, was that it just takes too much time. You got to go through a court. You got to have an FBI agent file an affidavit. And when you're dealing with foreign terrorist plots, often you got to deal in real time. You pick up something that suggests a plot is underway. You know, a target has been identified. And if you have to go through and wait for a federal judge to sign off, it could delay your response.
So as I said, the FISA process has always been broken, and you might remember that the so-called 20th 9/11 hijacker Zacharias Moussaoui, agents in Minneapolis were attempting to get a FISA warrant, but the gatekeepers at FBI headquarters said, no, you didn't have enough information. 6 months later, after 9/11, they were brought before the Joint House Senate Intelligence Committee, where they acknowledged they didn't know the legal standard to get a foreign intelligence surveillance warrant. They didn't know the legal standard. So if the bureaucrats are saying you have to protect us from ourselves by giving us more authority, you're going to still have that bureaucratic ineptitude, but now you're going to have access to a lot of information that law enforcement shouldn't have. So, you know, if you look at how actual failures have occurred, it's not often because of a lack of information, right? The 9/11 Commission report would have been 13 pages long, not 413 pages long. It's that there's too much information. It overwhelms everyone. And that's what we've created after 9/11 is this constant warning machine.
I wonder if AI is going to change the equation on this at all.
That's always been the promise, that somebody is going to invent some algorithm. But what I always tell law enforcement and national security folks who talk about this is, who on Wall Street is buying it? Because if nobody on Wall Street needs 0.5%, if your firm can get 0.5% advantage over the market, you will own all the money, all of it. There will be no Wall Street anymore. You will get it all. And if Wall Street isn't buying it, because these algorithms, no matter how good they are, can't predict the future. And even if they can predict trends, they can't predict rare events like acts of terrorism, like acts of espionage, right? That they come out in such a random fashion that it's very difficult for anyone to predict what is going to happen. So it's a flawed methodology from the beginning. And the reason that they went to these mass surveillance programs is because they didn't work. So that math, you know, Section 215 isn't working. Well, we need Section 702. Well, 702 isn't working. Okay, we need AI and we need Palantir and we need these outside groups to start helping us identify, because none of this is working. And that's, again, this sort of ever expanding national security ratchet, where pretty soon there are no rules anymore. And particularly when the rules are being enforced in secret, they can't.
And particularly when so much has been turned over, as you say, to the private sector.
And who is the private sector, right? I mean, it's fascinating. We built the part of my last Brennan Center paper. You know, I talked about fusion centers and these state and local law enforcement intelligence fusion centers that are linked with the military and counterterrorism efforts of DOJ and DOD and the FBI. There was a hack in 2020. Hacktivists went through a contractor to these fusion centers and got an enormous cache of data. So our tax dollars are being used to collect to create these centers that are collecting information about us, absent from any probable cause or reasonable suspicion, that is then handed over to anyone who can hack the system. And I would suggest that if hacktivists could have gotten that information and did get that information, that sophisticated hostile intelligence agencies had it a long time ago, right? So it's like we're creating one-stop shopping for foreign entities and involving these private contractors that don't have the same borders and values as the U.S. government does. We create just exponentially increases the risk that that collection about innocuous information about all of us can be used to do us harm.
And on that sobering note, I want to thank you, Mike, for a very thoughtful and important discussion. And these are obviously issues that we will be following closely at Spy Talk. So we will continue to monitor them and continue to check in with you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hockey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. MSW Media.
You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a thru hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's kachava.com and use code NEWS. KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.